Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What does it take to win multiple Grammy, Emmy, and Academy Awards, plus a Pulitzer Prize, a Tony, and three Golden Globes? My guest today is the only person who can tell us definitively because he is the only one in history who has done it. Marvin Hamlisch has been writing and performing music since he was a child and has given the world the scores for such enduring classics as A Chorus Line, The Sting, The Way We Were, and Sophie's Choice. His most recent score for last year's Steven Soderbergh film The Informant was nominated for a Golden Globe. But this week, the big win is for North Texas. Just today, the Dallas Symphony Orchestra announced Marvin Hamlisch will take over as principal pops conductor for the orchestra season that begins in August. We are delighted to have him with us to talk about it. Marvin, welcome. Welcome to Think and welcome to Dallas.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
You were something of a child prodigy, but your father was also a musician.
Right.
How old were you before you realized that you could do something that most people couldn't do?
Well, you know, I was about 5 1/2, 6 years old, and the one thing I could do was that I could hear a piece of music. I could then kind of go over to the piano and pick out the notes. But the thing that I really could do was then I could take those notes and I could play whatever I had learned in any key. I could just move it around, so to speak. And so my father, who was from Vienna, started asking people, what should I do? I have this kid who can really do something. And he kept hearing the word Juilliard. Now, Juilliard is really the word you want to hear for someone who wants to go into classical music. But, of course, he was saying, I have this child who loves music, you know what I mean? And so I think people who gave him the advice of Juilliard thought, oh, this is going to be the next, you know, Rachmaninoff or something like that. Turned out that I did get into Juilliard, but I got in really thinking of myself more as a person who was going to use what I learned to write and to do other things and get to Broadway and all this kind of stuff, because that's what I loved. I was not really meant for the classical world. But I was very lucky because Juilliard gave me all of the things you need to really be a good musician. So in the long run, it worked out fine, you know?
How much of that education was helpful in terms of learning to work with other musicians?
The whole thing about Juilliard is when you get out of there, you are a 100% total musician. You can talk about it. You can write it. You can do theory about it. You really know what you're doing because you've come grounded in this stuff. I mean, in terms of, you know, you've been learning all this. A lot of kids, unfortunately, graduate from Juilliard and are wildly eccentric because it's a pressure cooker. You are up against other brilliant kids, all from different parts of the world. And in my case, I was holding on very tightly to a scholarship. And that was not the easiest thing to maintain amongst these other great, talents. But because I had this good ear, and because in a way I kind of knew what I wanted to do, I was able to navigate for quite a while there. I was there from the age of 6 1/2 for about 14 years.
You were 21 when you had your first hit, is that right?
Right, Sunshine, Lollipops, and Rainbows.
What did it feel like the first time you heard that song on the radio?
Oh, let me tell you something. Whether it's the first time or the 2000th time, when you're sitting somewhere and all of a sudden you hear one of your tunes, it's just great. I mean, you just don't expect it, and it's out of nowhere. In fact, in the show that we wrote about such a moment where it happens and we wrote, they're playing our song, you know, oh, they're playing my song. It's all that. It's jubilation. It's total, wow, we made it. It's particularly great if you're in a car and you're just driving along and it comes up and you go, whoa, you know, like, whoa, they're playing it, you know. So it's a great, great feeling.
Was it terrifying at the same time to be that young? And did you think, oh my gosh, what if this is it?
You know, I've never had the fear of this is it. I've always deal with things like, well, it may never top such and such, you know, because if you've written Chorus Line at the age of 29, it's hard to top. But I never felt that I was going to go totally dry. You know, that I never felt. I don't know why. Maybe it's stupid because people go dry all the time. And I'm sure I've had my worst periods as opposed to always good periods. But I've never thought of that because I had a wonderful piano teacher who said to me, talent is like having a pump that you're pumping for cold water. The more you pump, the more you use the pump, the colder and fresher the water gets, right? So in terms of talent, he would say, the more you write, the more you do what you do, the more you use up your talent, new talent comes up, which is even fresher than the last. So I kind of believe that.
Was a little bit from One from A Chorus Line.
Right.
It's, you know, it's still, even for you, it's to hear those opening notes, everybody instantly knows what it is.
Right, right.
How do you know that a song, that it's perfect, that it's ready to go?
I'll tell you, it's easy to tell when it's ready to go. The hard part is to figure out if it's going to be successful. I mean, one of the strangest things about music and the arts is I can write something that I love. You know, and I live with it for a few days. I go, my God, this is brilliant. This is great. It gets to me. And no one likes it. And it's like it's a disaster. I mean, it means it didn't do it. I can also write something that I think is okay and people love it. Or occasionally you write something that you really like and other people really like it. Richard Rodgers said that when they asked him why he thought he was so successful, he said, I guess my opinion and the opinion of millions of other people is the same. And it's hard to find that. I mean, I never know what's going to make it. I just know if something's good. But those are not exactly equal because the public, as you know, picks things sometimes that are crazy and they love it. So you have to hope for the best on all these things. But as far as when something's ready, after you've written something, usually the next day, you think it's the greatest thing that ever was because you've just had the birth pains. You know?
Yeah.
But if 5 days later you go back to the piano and you play it and you still get a kick out of it, it's pretty good. Then you go, you know, this really gets to me.
Do you always work at the piano?
Yeah, I really do. I mean, I feel very comfortable at the piano. And I always work at the piano, yeah.
Are there things that you play for yourself, whether they're things that you've written or other people have, just to comfort yourself after a bad day?
Oh, sure. Naturally. I mean, I'm not at the piano every day, by the way. But on so to speak, the bad days, yeah, that's wonderful just to sit there. Because, you know, the thing about music is you do get away from it all when you're playing music. It's like, that's it. You know, all of a sudden there is no Haiti. There is no war. There is no Middle East problem. You know, there's none of that stuff exists. There's no CNN. There's nothing. There's just you and the music, and you're very happy. The problem is that you can't really escape from reality. You can only hold it off for a while, you know? But yes, when things are rough, for me, you noodle at the piano. You really do. You just sit there and you just kind of freely put out there whatever you want to put out there. And sometimes you get very lucky. You go, oh, that was really good, you know? And other times you just sit around noodling, and it's fun. It feels good.
Are you actually, when you're working on a composition, are you sort of writing and making notes to yourself, or will you remember something that you've just worked through?
Normally you remember it, but it depends how much you write. If after a while you're really writing a lot, then you got to get it on paper. Or what I do normally is I would tape it first. I just put it on tape recorder. and then wait a day or two and then play it back and see how I feel about it. One of the great problems in writing is the following. When you write something, when you finish, you think this is the greatest thing I've ever written in my life. Just because you finished. Little do you know that a day later, after a day, you look at it and go, you know what, this really isn't good, you know? A lot of the stuff that you're so exhilarated by, you're only exhilarated because for that moment it was wonderful, but it doesn't really pass any other test. It was just good for that moment. What you're looking for is something that's going to pass the test of time, that's going to be there for a while. Those are hard to come by, but when they come, you kind of get a kind of electric charge up your spine, and you know you've got something.
Is that what you love about Pops, that it really is the best of what Americans in particular have composed?
Well, yeah. I mean, Pops really stands for popular music, but it stands for the music that came out of the 20s, 30s, and 40s, particularly on Broadway, and those songs. And those songs are standards. There's no doubt about it. I mean, you know, a wedding that's going to take place 3,000 years from now is still going to have My Funny Valentine played. Just how it is. So these songs are tried and true, and they work, and they always get to you. They just get to you. I think that's the one thing I miss the most in today's music. Today's music is frenetic, loud, here and there a melody, here and there a beat. But the key for me on music usually is, does it get the hairs of my back up? Do I go, whoa, you know? I hardly do that with modern music. It's just how it is. It doesn't get to me. But the minute I go back a little bit, I go, wow, you know, it's just, you know, and some people are just better at it than others, you know? So if you're talking Bacharach and David, yeah, they really wrote songs. And Elton John writes songs, but other people just write, I don't know, riffs. They're almost like they don't really have a melody. They just have these riffs that keep coming at you, you know?
It's interesting to the extent that music is almost like a drug. You know, it can intensify sadness and it can intensify
right.
joy. It's one of the few things that you can do in a room with 5,000 other people and have the same set of emotions.
Oh, definitely. Let me tell you something. Music, particularly in a film, is there to heighten whatever emotion it is that you're trying to make more of. And that's what it does. And it particularly does it sometimes when you don't even realize it's doing it. You think it's all coming from the screen. Little do you know that some of it's coming from the music. And you're not really listening to it, but you are, you know, somehow. And it gets to you. And that's the beauty of music, that it can be subtle, and yet it can really find its way into your heart and into your psyche. Definitely.
What do you want to know about the intent of a film before you start to score one?
I definitely want to know what the director is thinking and want to know what he's looking for. I want to know what are you asking me to do here so that we're all, you know, talking the same language. And if I don't agree with you, let me tell you what I'd like to be doing and let's see if we can come to a meeting of the minds, because you have to have the director and the composer on the same track here. Otherwise, everyone's going to kill each other. I mean, mm-hmm. they're just going to, you know, knock each other out. So, yeah, it's very important to listen to the director, make notes about what he says about every scene so that you just know what he's looking for.
My guest this hour is conductor and composer Marvin Hamlisch. He has just been announced as the new principal Pops conductor for the Dallas Symphony Orchestra. We'll resume our conversation in a couple of minutes, and you can join us now by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. Hundreds of non-credit personal enrichment and professional development courses begin this spring. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
That is The Entertainer. And, of course, that was from the film The Sting. My guest this hour, Marvin Hamlisch, newly announced principal pops conductor for the Dallas Symphony Orchestra. Join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Now, in that film, you were adapting a lot of music that Scott Joplin had written.
Right. What happened was that the director of the film, George Roy Hill, had the idea of using the Scott Joplin music. So I had to go to the library first and just get the music to see what I had to choose from. What was astonishing was that the songs that I really liked worked just perfectly in the film. It was just like they were, you almost felt like they wrote them for the film because they were so perfect in terms of timing for it. So I got the job and did it in like 5 or 6 days, but I didn't want to tell the studio that it only took me 6 days. So I waited for about 4 weeks, and I called up. I said, well, I'm really giving this my best shot. You know, it's really coming along, but I need another week or two, you know, just to make it sound like I was really working. Because everything just followed. It just went in perfectly. It just laid in. You went, I need 52 seconds. You found it. You went, well, this is it. It works. Probably still the best film I've ever worked on. Just a perfect film. Unbelievable film, you know?
Do you go back and watch those sometimes?
If they're on television, yeah. I mean, I don't go over to my library of CDs and say I have to watch it. No. But if it's on television, sure, I catch it. I'm very proud of that film, so, you know, that's an easy one to watch.
Did that give you a sort of a skewed sense of the ease with which you might be able to score other films?
Well, one of the reasons it was so simple was because I wasn't writing anything. I just had to adapt it. It was easy, you know? When you're writing something from scratch, you hope that you're making up something that's really good because, I mean, that's what you're stuck with. Here, we knew the basic material was good to begin with. So we were already starting way ahead of the game, you know, because you're starting with music that's already exists. But The Sting was wonderful also because it was a very cheap album to make. So it was doable. You know, the studio wanted it real bad. And the next thing you know, it sells 1 million records. You know, so out of nothing comes this big phenomena, you know. I mean, who buys, what do you call it, these kind of songs, these kind of ditties, who buys that? You know, who takes it? Well, if you love the film, you bought it. And so many people love the film, they went crazy. You know, they really did.
Did you also play on that?
Yep, mm-hmm. That's me.
Mm-hmm. Is it a different kind of energy entirely when you're performing as opposed to composing or conducting?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things is with performing, you get initially immediate response. People either applaud or they boo, but you get response. And applause is addictive. Applause becomes, you just become an addict. If you're composing, it's a very quiet business. It's you alone in a room trying hard to figure something out. And then eventually you play it for somebody. And if they like it, they go, yeah, I like it. It's okay. You know. But it's not that instant thing that you get from when you're performing, which is just, whoa. You know, if they love it, boy, you're home free.
And I guess there's also, you know, when you've got an audience, they'll influence each other. So if a few
sure.
people really adore it, then everybody else says, yeah, this is great.
There's definitely that. You know, it's the same thing like when laughter starts in a theater and it starts off in one part of the theater and mm-hmm. it just builds. Yeah, it's the same thing. Empathy builds. It really does. It starts off in somewhere people say, I really like this. And it travels. So it's wonderful to watch. And that film was wonderful because it was such a good film, and yet it was very funny. So people were laughing, and you got laughs in the theater, but you also got this real appreciation of what it meant to put two people like Newman and Redford together and get chemistry like you don't see anymore. I mean, you know, that's chemistry that those two guys really had it. They just had this thing about them that's unbelievable, you know. You can't buy that. You can't teach it. You can't do anything. You just are happy to see it once in your lifetime.
How important is chemistry when you're working with a lyricist?
It's a marriage. And a marriage sometimes works out great. Sometimes you want to divorce the person. sometimes you realize you got the wrong person, you know. It's just like a marriage. I'm working with a fellow now that I'm really having a good time with. His name is Rupert Holmes. He was the guy that wrote years ago Edwin Drood, the musical. Mm-hmm. And he's writing the book and the lyrics on the show that we're doing now, which is The Nutty Professor, based on the Jerry Lewis film. And he's really very, very good. But there's no doubt that there are days when you just want to shoot each other, you know, so you have to be very careful. But so far, everything's been very nice and very civilized on that project.
I guess if you care enough about something, it's hard not to come into conflict sometimes.
Very hard, because, you know, you're seeing it. I mean, I'm seeing it from the point of view of his music. He's seeing it from a totally different point of view, you know, and everyone's seeing it. You know, everybody, it's like going into a restaurant, and if you're with a pastry chef, they won't talk about the steak. They'll talk about the apple pie. You know what I mean? I mean, you have to decide what it is that you're really looking at. You know, what are we watching here? But I've had a joy working with Rupert on this thing, and I'm hoping to have this out in 2011. I can't swear to it yet, but it's getting there.
It's got to be hard for you, being so much in demand, to decide when you're going to accept a project.
Well, when I accept a project, usually it's because the director is a really good director. And I love working with really smart directors. I just did a film with Steven Soderbergh, which was The Informant. Anytime you get a really strong director, I'm like into it. I want to be part of that. I want to be part of that event. So that's very important to me.
And you actually got that gig because he went back and watched Bananas?
He watched Bananas and loved the fact that the music was funny and that it was very energetic. So he came to me and he said, I want in this film, the Informant, I want people to know it's funny. Well, the truth was I did it very kind of wildly, and he was very happy with it, and it was a score that was talked about a lot. But you have to really see the movie in context with the music to see why it's funny. You know, hearing it on a CD is one thing, but to see it with the movie is when you really start laughing.
Well, we're going to have to visualize right now because we do have a clip. So tell us what's going on in that scene in The Informant when we hear that.
Okay, well, you have to understand something to begin with The Informant. The Informant, the character, the guy who this is really about, who's a real person, by the way, Mr. Whitaker, was bipolar. Being bipolar, it turned out to be, for me, the key to the whole movie was that, well, if you're bipolar, it means that everything's like 180 different. So you might be churning inside, but to the outside world, you're giving off this wonderful, I'm happy-go-lucky guy. If you're thinking of the FBI, well, then they're kind of stupid in your head, so therefore they get kazoos. Everybody gets something different because it's all skewed differently. So the score turns out to be this combination of wildly, you know, off-the-wall cues, but that they're each built around the fact that this is not the person he really is. This is just the inner voice of this guy. And I'm becoming the ombudsman for that person. So it's a very off the wall, irregular score. So in that scene, for instance, there was a raid going on, and it was all FBI men. And so every time you hear wah, wah, you know what I mean? Those are the FBI, because to him, they are stupid. They're dumb. You know what I mean? And we're going to see everything through his eyes, but we're going to listen to it through our ears. You know, is what's happening. It's a very wonderful film, and it's a wonderful performance by Matt Damon particularly. Mm-hmm. Just incredible.
That was the first film score you'd done in, what, 12 or 13
yeah,
years?
Yeah, right.
Had you just decided you wanted to take a break from that for a while?
I wanted to take a break, number one. Number two, I wasn't really getting films with directors that I thought were really great. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not a guy who's going to do Transformers 47. You know, I'm just not going to do it. You know,
you don't need the paycheck at this point.
No, it's a waste of time for me. I mean, I'm not interested. I'm interested in writing some really good music, you know, not sound effects music, you know, boom, 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 boom. But with Soderbergh, when he asked me to do it, there's no way you're going to refuse him. I mean, you know you're working with a really genius director. And I get a big kick out of that. That's what I like, because you learn something. Every time out, you learn something from these people. Yeah, I mean, I hope that I don't have to stay away from the movies that long. But when you're working on a show, when you're doing all these concerts, there comes a point where you just don't have any more time, you know? So you have to kind of make the time if you can.
Marvin Hamlisch is my guest. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Let's go to Becky in Trophy Club. Hi, Becky.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I am just so excited to speak to Mr. Hamlisch. I want to thank him for his many, many years of wonderful music that we catch ourselves humming and we don't even remember or realize where it came from. But I agree with him on his views about popular music today. I come from a family of musically inclined, especially my children and my husband. I'm not. I only can play the radio. But my son is a music major in college at Fayetteville, Arkansas. And he has a very well-rounded musical taste. However, my 16-year-old daughter is a different story. She just listens to today's modern music and boom, 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 gives me a headache. I mean, I stress out when I drive.
So, Becky, I'm guessing that you're hoping for...
But anyway, my question, Mr. Hamlisch, is how could I get my daughter to have a little more well-rounded taste in music and enjoy some of the more, the more classical types of music? She just
I think we got it, Becky. I really appreciate your call, and let's make sure we have time to get a response for you. Thank you so much.
Well, you know, it's a good question because where do you hear this music? I mean, think about it. Where do you hear the music that's really good? Well, what I did finally was I don't know if this is really a plug for them, but the truth is on radio, the only place that I found where you can really hear this stuff mostly is either on Sirius or XM radio, because there you dial in what you want to hear, whether it's music from the 40s, whether it's music from Frank Sinatra, whether it's Broadway, whether it's – and it's very eclectic because you decide what you want to hear. But the nice thing about it is the more you hear it, the more you just love it. I mean, you can't help it. I've always said that the youth of America, one of the problems in today's world and over the last 10 years is that there's no more Ed Sullivan Show. There's no more a place where, I mean, as I grew up, Some Enchanted Evening sung by Enzio Pinza was on the Ed Sullivan Show. Mm-hmm. Boom. And that's how you got turned on to South Pacific, you know? You've got to do it now with the iPods and with the XM radios and stuff like that, because that's the only place they're playing it. But my feeling, which I think is true, is that once her daughter actually hears this stuff, she'll be fine. There's no reason why you have to pick one or the other. There's no reason why you can't have your hip hop in your life, your rock and roll, and your show music. Why not? I mean, who said no? You know. So yeah, that's the way to me to go about it.
So there were no fights about music when you were growing up in your house?
Well, you know, you always have your parents who are going to tell you what you're listening to is lousy. I mean, that's just the way life is. I mean, it's made. What are parents here for? But to tell you, to tell you that everything you listen to is wrong. I mean, we were listening to ba 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 ba. Good night, sweetheart. Right? I mean, all those of the 50s and the ba 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 ba. But the truth of the matter is, even those songs, with all its little, you know, craziness, they still had melodies. I mean, they weren't, they were real, you know. I mean, one of my favorite melodies ever was in the 50s on a song called Come Home With Me, bum, dum, be dum, bum, come and go with me. I mean, great melodies. So at least we were grounded in those melodies. And in those days, you could actually understand the lyric. In the same way that I am always amazed when I go to the Apple store and I see these young kids at 6 years old being able to use any computer without reading the directions. They just come into the shop, bang, and they know how to do it. In the same way, in those days, we all understood the lyric. We all got it. Now how a kid understands lyrics is beyond me. I mean, I hear the same song that they're listening to and I go, what'd she say? You know, and they explain everything to me. So yes, the older generation always hates the younger generation stuff. I mean, always. But it doesn't mean that you can't listen to everything. It doesn't mean that you can't listen to what's happening today contemporarily and at the same time want to put on Cole Porter. I mean, what I still don't see why one is necessarily stops the other one. It doesn't. You know, they're perfectly fine.
Marvin, the world is full of people my age who wish that they'd kept up with the piano lessons they took when they were eight. I'm guessing you were never a kid who had to be compelled to practice.
Well, I had to be compelled only because, you know, if it was up to me, I'd be playing just the rock and roll. I mean, I had to play the Bach and Beethoven, and my mother had a very good way of doing it, which was, you want to have your tuna fish sandwich? Start, you know, playing your Chopin. You know what I mean? But, yeah, there was a bit of compelling going on. But in the long run, my father probably said the smartest thing ever to me when he said, I said to him, what am I going to Juilliard for? What do I need this for? And he very calmly said, look, I know you're never going to be the next, you know, great pianist. He said, but if you want to compose your songs, you have to show them in a way that people can listen to them and enjoy them without going, oh, my God, what a lousy piano player. So he said, that's why you're learning the piano. And that kept me on the straight road. That kept me on, okay, I better learn this because this is going to make me a better pianist. And it did. So he was absolutely right.
Marvin Hamlisch is my guest. He has just been announced as the principal pops conductor for the Dallas Symphony Orchestra. We'll talk more after the break, and you can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org.
Support for KERA comes from you, our members, and from Texas Oncology, encouraging annual cancer screenings because early detection is key to survival. More at TexasOncology.com. Loot Riley Honda, offering a wide range of repair services including brake repair, AC, preventive maintenance, and more. LootRileyHonda.com.
Every week, our moms talk about issues ranging from caring for twin infants.
It's hard to do with one person and two babies, you know, swaddling them both and holding them both and rocking them both. But you do the best that you can.
To having tough talks with teens.
I think we really need to get to know our kids, know what's going on in their lives, and talk to them about these things.
Join us for our weekly dose of parenting know-how next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 2 on KERA 90.1.
The Art and Seat calendar for Tuesday features Signers, Free Admission, and Cinderella. The University of Texas at Tyler presents a Cinderella story at the Cohen Fine and Performing Arts Center. The show features a 9-piece jazz band and ballet. The Women's Museum in Dallas offers free admission today. Visitors will have access to permanent exhibitions as well as the special exhibit, Woman's Work, selected prints from the collection of the Montgomery Museum of Fine Arts. The University of North Texas Media Library screens Valentino, the Last Emperor. The documentary provides a behind-the-scenes look at the world of high fashion. And in Weatherford, the Alamo and Texas Independent Signers continues at the Doss Heritage and Culture Center. The exhibit celebrates Texas history. For these and other events, visit artandseek.org. For Art and Seek, I'm Nella Farsala, and this is 90.1 KERA, Dallas-Fort Worth, Denton.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. Hundreds of non-credit personal enrichment and professional development courses begin this spring. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is conductor and composer Marvin Hamlisch. He has just been announced as the principal pops conductor for the Dallas Symphony Orchestra. That season starts in August. Join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or emailing think@kera.org. So during the break, I saw you sort of interacting with all the music that was playing. Are you always thinking like a composer when you hear a new little bit of music, or what are you thinking?
No, I'm just enjoying it. I'm just having a good time with it. You know, it's very lovely music, and it's very, you know, got a nice feel, a nice beat. You know, I give it a six. You know, give it a six. No, but I like listening to it. Lovely, very relaxing.
What does it sound like? How different is the sound when you are in the audience at a musical performance as opposed to, I guess performing is very different, but even conducting?
Well, you know, if you're in the audience, the truth of the matter is what you're trying to do is you're trying to get yourself into a mood to be able to just listen to music. And sometimes the best mood is to be very relaxed, very calm, and just let it waft over you. When you're making the music, however, what you're trying to do is to be very clear to the musicians. You want to be sure that they know what it is that you're hoping to get out of this performance. And that's not just about the tempo. That's about the whole feeling of the piece. And it's tricky because, I mean, I don't conduct every day, number one. And number two, when I do conduct, sometimes I feel that certain performances just are better than others. And I don't know why. Meaning I can't figure out, what did I do today? Why did I not quite hit it right? But the other day I hit it just, you know what I mean? I don't know. But when you walk away from one and you think, oh, I really did a good one there, it's joy. I mean, it really is. It's, you just go, wow. And when you don't do a good one, you try to figure out, what was it about that other one that I loved so much that I can't get it anymore? You know, it's very frustrating. So the joy, I guess, is in trying to keep doing it, you know, just to keep it going, you know. And sometimes you succeed, sometimes you fail.
It's really physically demanding, or at least it seems to be. And I know, you know, Jaap van Zweden has been injured conducting. Do you have to have a certain kind of workout to stay in shape for conducting?
I should have a workout because having nothing to do with conducting. This is going to sound like the biggest cop-out in the world, but sometimes I get so busy, I swear to you, I don't have the time to do a workout.
Yeah.
I don't have the time to do anything except do the thing. Yes, some concerts can be very strenuous, and I'm always amazed at conductors who are able to just play much longer ones than I do and conduct and just keep going. I find it amazing. It's like an endurance test. But there are tricks to the trade to a degree on how you can get a little bit less totally, you know, wild in terms of your own ability to be able to do this. The truth is, I think the best advice to any conductor that I would have is listen to the music. Meaning, yes, you can get totally enthralled with yourself and what your hands are doing and how you're doing it. But in the long run, what's going to make you conduct it really well is to listen to what you got that night. Not to expect anything. Just to say, I'm going to listen tonight, and tonight's performance, what will guide me is the listening to it, because then I'll know what I have to do. I'll know how to adjust. And that is an art. In fact, one of the most important things for an orchestra to do is listen to themselves. Not just listen to their part, but listen to what their little band of players on the right side, how that differs from the people over on the left side, and how are they supposed to, you know, where are they supposed to be on the totem pole in terms of importance, you know? Very important to know at every given moment where you lie, so to speak. Where are you in this maze, you know? And that's what a good rehearsal and a good conductor does. He lets you know when you're really foreground and when you just would be much better off to just cool it, you know?
Do you feel like you're playing the orchestra in the same way you would play the piano?
Not really, because you see, on the piano, you control every note. Anything that's going to be played, you control it. It's going to come from one of those fingers. With the orchestra, so little is going to come from those fingers. I mean, so little. It's, you know, yes, you know, you ask the trumpets to do something, they're going to blow. They're going to blow it. You ask the violins, they're going to finger it. They're going to figure it out. You don't really do that much to make the sound. You just hopefully do much to almost conduct traffic and make sure that the traffic amongst the players is correct. And then everybody knows where they're supposed to be at a certain time, you know? You're supposed to be hotter, you're supposed to be cooler, you're supposed to be this, that. And given the amount of rehearsal, which is very little on shows, you hope that an orchestra, slowly but surely, the more you work with them, they get to know all your shortcuts. And that makes it very, very quick to be able to rehearse, because then they know, oh, do this, do this, do that, and you don't have to talk about it again.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Carol in Mesquite. Hi, Carol.
Hi. My question to you is, how in the world did we lure you to Dallas?
Tortilla soup. You know, if we had tortilla soup in New York, I'd still be there.
Slice of avocado on the top.
Of course. Hey, you know. I mean, you know, you've got – no, the truth of the matter is that I've been here many times. I have lots of friends in Dallas. I really do. Love this orchestra. I feel really almost like I'm coming home here every time I come here. I just love the city. And so it wasn't that big a deal to lure me. I was thrilled when they asked. I said, terrific. It feels like a very good fit. And I think the symphony and myself know what we want to do and what we want to, you know, get accomplished. So I think we're all on the same track.
How does the Meyerson compare acoustically to other places you've worked?
The Meyerson as a hall is a great hall. There's no question about that. Wonderful acoustics. There's no problem with that. The one thing that has always bothered me about the hall, and I spoke today too about it, because it wasn't built for pops. And I'll tell you what I mean by that. Once you put a piano up there and you come into the hall, there's almost no room for anybody else. So if you want dancing or you want, I don't know, four singers, it's very hard to figure out where do I put these people. And yet, on a pop show, that's what you get. You get a lot of those people. So I had to talk today about, well, how do you have your cake and eat it? And the way you have your cake and eat it basically is that when they have an extension that they can put together, they lose 200 seats. And you gain 15 feet. But when you do that, if you sell what used to be the room for the choir, if you sell the choir seats, then you can sell 300 seats. So you were going to sell 200 before, and now you can sell 300, so you can actually make a little extra on the extra 100 people. So because I really want the Christmas show to be something very, very special and stuff, we've decided to use the extension for that show, losing about 100 people in the audience, but hopefully getting them to come back via the chairs in the choir. That's the only thing about the hall that has bothered me, which was they never really thought about giving you enough room without losing those 100 people.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Hearst and speak with Stephen. Hey, Stephen.
Hello. Hi, Mr. Hamilton. It's an honor to speak with you, and again, welcome to Dallas.
Thank you very much.
My question is regarding specifically vocalists. You spoke earlier about how the style of popular music has changed, and with sort of the American idolization of music, do you have trouble finding really good, have you seen theater singers that can just, you know, sustain a note and not dance all around
right.
Really take those older songs and do them well?
Yeah, in fact, what I normally do is if we have, like, for instance, for Berlin and Richard Rodgers, we'll get two singers probably from New York. They won't be famous singers necessarily, but they'll be good singers. You know, they won't be someone that's going to make a big difference at the box office, but they will be professionally well-trained singers that can do anything because those songs are very sophisticated and you need people who can do what they do. But you're right. There is, you know, the pop ballad, the really big ballad, has become the song of the year. I mean, everything's got to be boom, bada boom, bada boom, you know. And after a while, it gets tiring. I don't know about you, but I just get tired of it. It's like, here comes another killer ballad. Mm-hmm. You know, come on, guys. So we've gotten used to that. And to a degree, it's a little bit more showy than it is really good. You know, it's just like, you're going to show me what you can do, you know, your knockout punch, you know what I mean? But there are still people who really know how to sing and dance, basically. And they're usually in the chorus of some show, and you just try to find some of these people and have a roster of them so that when you need them, if I had more shows than one or two going out, I would have more singers that can do this kind of stuff because it's very important. It really is. It's you know, I can have the best material in the world, but if I don't have the singer there to do it, to pull it over, it isn't going to happen, you know? So it's very important.
How has it happened that in so many cases there are these brilliantly talented musicians who don't become famous, and yet there are other people that we glorify, and
right.
A lot of people tend to assume the famous ones must be the best?
You know, there is an element of luck, and there's also an element of pure chutzpah. Certain people just have the ability push forward no matter what. Mm-hmm. and other people hear a little bit of a rejection and they just leave. Why is it that somebody is a big star and another person who's 3 months, you know, her junior, doesn't make it? I don't know. You know, it's weird because you're schooled on the fact that you think talent does it all, but it's not true, not in today's world. Talent is a major component, but now there's so many other things that go involved in with a Broadway show that you almost have to hedge your bet and say to yourself, well, we're going to try here, but if this doesn't work, let me tell you what I'm really going to be doing, you know? There's a lot of talent out there, and there's a lot of competition out there, and that's actually good for the industry. That's always good. But we live in very precarious times right now, and people now are using their money to go to the theater. They love that, but they're not going anywhere else. They're not taking too many dinners in New York anymore. They're going, you know, locally. And things are changing. They just are. And you might as well get used to it because it's not going to get better that quick. You know, it'll get better, but not fast. So hold on to your pocketbook.
When you go out to the theater in New York, obviously people, as you walk in, know exactly right, yeah. who you are. Is that sort of stressful when there people all around you are aware of that and you're just trying to react?
Yeah.
And
it's rough, to be honest with you, because you want to go in as John Q. Public and just find out the experience for yourself. But sometimes you just can't because, as you said, people are there. People get very upset if after one act I leave the theater. You can bet that that's going to be in the paper the next day. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you leave because you can't stand the show. Sometimes you've seen the show already. You wanted to just see the first act again, and they're giving you, attributing terrible quotes to you that you didn't say.
So then it's like Hamlish walked out.
Yeah, right, exactly. And you didn't. That's not exactly what happened. So I try as much as I can never to walk out of a show, no matter what it is, just to stick with it and make sure that I've told that person who I am, who I'm with, whatever, so there's no one's upset with me. You know what I mean? We got enough problems with being people upset. So this way is we start off with nobody being upset, you know?
Is there a place where you perform that feels most like home?
I have had the good fortune of working twice in the last 3 years with the New York Philharmonic Orchestra. Hometown boy working in New York at Carnegie Hall with New York's Phil. It's about as good as it gets right there. That'll do it. That'll do it. That'll take care of it all. Great pride.
Having won so many awards, does it start to be not a big deal or almost like, is it almost more disappointing since you've got shelves full of these things if something doesn't get an award?
Well, I mean, today's a perfect day for you. I mean, I was totally stunned that I didn't get a nomination for the Informant.
I was surprised by that, too. In fact, I was going to put it in my script and then it wasn't
I was
there.
Surprised because it's one of the few films ever where the music got spoken about in many normal newspapers. It's one thing to be spoken about in Hollywood Reporter or Variety because that's what they do. They have to give technical credits. And they usually say things like, technical credits apt. You know what I mean? That's
yeah.
it. You know? But they have to give something, you know. But the New York Times doesn't have to mention it. The Los Angeles Times doesn't have to mention it. All these papers don't have to mention it. They all did. The fact that we didn't get a nomination, I'm not talking about winning, I'm just talking about a nomination, was, to be honest with you, very disappointing. So thankfully, I'm able to be here in a place that I really love and getting over it as we keep going. I'm just, you know, going to learn to live with it and keep going. I'm not going to tell anybody that it didn't bother me because it did bother me. Also, it's so early in the morning, it drives you crazy, you know. You find out at like, 7:30 in the morning that you're a loser. You know?
And then there's no going back to bed.
No going back to bed.
Well, we're really excited to have you in Dallas.
Well, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Marvin Hamlish is the principal pops conductor for the Dallas Symphony Orchestra. You can learn more at DallasSymphony.com and also check out Stephen Becker's new interviews with Marvin Hamlish at ArtAndSeek.com. My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.